United States v. Shelby. Mr. Chang.
May it please the Court, Edmund Chang of the United States. The District Court here relied on two grounds to cut nearly in half the defendant's drug sentence. The first ground was that, in the District Court's view, the defendant...
Wait a minute.
Yes,
Judge. You play baseball?
I do.
You follow baseball?
I do.
There was a time in baseball when a batter could argue balls and strikes. Umpire would say, strike. The batter could turn around and argue and say, that was a ball. Eventually, that rule was changed because it slowed everything down. You cannot argue balls and strikes. Here's a case where the government comes in and asks for a cooperation, substantial assistance, reduction from 24 to 22 years, which isn't very much to begin with. And a judge gives a little bit more. Are there any cases that you feel that just isn't, it's like a ball or a strike, isn't worth arguing about? This guy has been in prison since 1996. He just turned 40. And the judge looked at the very good record he had in prison and gave him a little more of a sentence reduction than the one that that you had asked for. I don't know. You know, I understand and appreciate the right of the government to appeal when a judge does something that you disagree with. But it ought to be just major disagreements, I would think. And this one, I think, could have just passed. It's a ball or a strike, and you shouldn't argue about it.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree that...
Well, then we absolutely agree,
Honor,
that that's the end of the case.
You stopped me a little early, Judge.
We affirm.
I agree that that the executive branch ought to exercise carefully its discretion and not take an appeal on every decision that we just have some disagreement with. And a very good example of that are the many below-range sentences that are imposed in the district court. We take a pass on virtually all of them in taking an appeal. But in this case, I think there are, without getting into our deliberative process, there are a couple things. One, the strike zone completely changed. So this set a legal precedent.
Well, sure, wait. The strike zone changed also because when this guy was sentenced in 1999... The sentencing guidelines were rigid, mandatory. Maybe he wouldn't have got the kind of sentence he originally got under a system that we now operate under.
I think that is right, because indeed Judge Corus said that at his initial sentencing that he probably wouldn't have given him that sentence. But just because Booker is now the law and the guidelines are advisory doesn't mean that under Rule 35B or under Section 3553E that Booker applies. You know, Booker does not apply to every, in particular, sentencing reductions. This Court has already held, for example, under 3582C2, which provides for sentencing reductions if there's a retroactive change in the guidelines. That Booker does not come in through the back door. And we don't think Booker comes in through the back door just because there is now a sentencing reduction for substantial assistance. In fact, 2 weeks ago, this Court held in the DiRico Johnson case that Booker has not altered Section 3553.
But that was for going below a mandatory minimum. That's different.
Well, it's true that that's for going below a mandatory minimum. But Rule 35B as this Court knows, was directly enacted by Congress at the same time it enacted 3553E. And at that time, that prior version contained the very same language that this Court relied on in the Thomas case in the 1990s, and more recently, again, in the Johnson case, to limit a district court's decision-making when reducing
a
sentence.
Arguing for symmetry between 35B and 3553, isn't that right?
I am arguing for symmetry, Your Honor.
But I assume you're also worried just about losing control, because if you file a motion to reduce his sentence by 2 years, and the next thing you know, it's down by what? By 9?
Right. It's very close to 9 years, and that's I think the other point that is important here. We acknowledge that under Rule 35B, unlike at an initial sentencing, right, where we often are able to negotiate with a defendant under Rule 11C1C, a binding agreement that binds a district judge as to what the cooperation discount ought to be. We acknowledge we don't have that power under Rule 35B, and the judge does have discretion to consider the value of the substantial assistance and exercise discretion in that. And that is another example, Judge Evans, where if there is disagreement as to the value of the substantial assistance, I've had cases myself where we have not taken an appeal if the judge disagrees with our assessment and gives some additional time off, more than we asked for. But here, it wasn't just a little bit more. So in terms, not only did the strike zone change, but this is well outside the strike zone. We asked for a 10% reduction, going from 295 months to 265 months.
For substantial assistance.
For substantial assistance.
Only.
That's correct. And, right, that was what the government placed on the value of the defendant's substantial assistance. And when we asked for just a 10% reduction, I think that the record reflects that was an appropriate assessment. And this was a defendant who provided historical information about gang members going back into the 1980s and the 1990s. And yes, we used that information in a massive complaint affidavit, but we also had a lot of other evidence against those other defendants. And then he provided some information about a current subject that the government was trying to identify, that person. So we thought the value of that assistance was worth about a 10% reduction. And one of the reasons we thought that was we also knew that the defendant had basically disabled himself from ever testifying as opposed to providing information for a complaint affidavit.
Well, that's the reason that you only went 10%. You see, you put a value on it. The question here, though, is going beyond substantial assistance, reigniting the 3553 standards about how his family, he's kept in touch with his family, got a GED, did a lot of other things in the meantime besides this, and got cleaned his act up in prison. As you know, the United States versus Grant on the Sixth Circuit, on the majority of that court takes a position that that Shelby's taking here, that you can do that. The dissent says no, and I think our courts have implied a little bit that this goes beyond. And that's really the question here. Do we reopen? If you open the door for substantial assistance, does that open the door wider for the court to then go and re-look at and apply the 3553? That seems to be where we are here, and we will have a split with the Sixth Circuit if we don't allow that, right?
That's correct. We think the Sixth Circuit wrongly decided the Grant case, and
I didn't read Grant, but it was obviously in the Federal Defender's 28J letter. But what was the date of that decision?
I have it here. It's on June 9th, 2009. That's
right.
We cited it in our
reply brief as adverse authority. So, we're asking you to disagree with the majority in Grant because the Sixth Circuit, we think, focused on simply the absence of this limitation, which was removed, as the advisory committee note states, only for stylistic purposes.
Now, isn't it your concern, though, and if you move forward, as you did, as a belated, I'll call it, a 35 reduction, not after 1 year, but beyond that, that this precedent would open the door to do this with everybody?
Well, to be candid, the government would have a concern that we would lose control over the substantial assistance reduction motions if all of the 3553A factors get, as you said, reignited or reintroduced at this stage. Under 3553E, we have sort of the We have the backstop of the statutory language and now the Johnson case, which says that the only factor that the court can consider is substantial assistance. We don't have that. You know, if that limitation is removed in Rule 35B, yes, to be candid, the government is concerned that we'll get reductions like this where this defendant, who really barely qualifies.
Yeah, well, you would file fewer of these substantial assistance motions because you've got you'd have a downside risk that you don't have under your current understanding of the
grant. I think that without that limitation, we would have a disincentive to file what we consider.
Not really. You'd have to negotiate it with the defense, wouldn't you?
No, Your Honor.
Sure. You say we'll file a substantial assistance reduction motion, provided you'll agree that it'll be 3 years or 4 years, and you won't argue for anything more.
Right, but Judge Evans, two things about that. One is that still would not bind the district court. That does not that agreement, unlike a C1C agreement, it would just be between the parties, and we can't bind the district court. And Your Honor, the reality is because that does happen. It didn't happen in this case. In this case, the defendant was free to recommend whatever sentence the defendant thought the value of the substantial assistance was worth. But there are cases where we negotiate with the defense and we say, we'll make this motion if you agree it'll be, you know, some certain percentage or some time off. And, you know, I will tell you that, you know, we sometimes face a situation where the defense counsel, they live up to that agreement, but, you know, but they present, obviously, a full presentation of all the mitigation arguments and it has an effect on the district, you know, the district judge in terms of assessing how deep the reduction ought to be. And so the reality is that negotiation is not a sufficient protection, I think, for the government's concerns. But it's not just the government's concerns. It really, again, it's the text and the history and the purpose of Rule 35B sentencing reductions are for substantial assistance. And it makes no sense to have Rule 35B and 3553E diverge from each other. They were enacted together. They had the same text. And the removal of the text, the specific text at issue in this case, was for stylistic purposes only, and it was not meant for substantive effect. If I could reserve that 1 minute left for, well, actually,
5 minutes.
The remainder of the rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chang. Mr. Cook?
May it please the court, Mr. Chang. My name is Dan Cook. I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellee, Gregory Shelby. Essentially, I'd like to point out three things before I begin. First is that our argument essentially mirrors, I think we've made that clear in our brief, the district court opinion in United States v. Park. That district court set forth four reasons why you can consider the 3553A factors in this situation, and that's four reasons we adopt. I'd also like to mention United States v. Grant, the Sixth Circuit case, and Judge Mannion's point that decision that favors the government would create a circuit split. And lastly, I'd like to note United States v. Chapman, because in our opinion, this issue has been decided by this court in Chapman.
No, that's not correct.
I think there is language in Chapman.
Anyway, look, get to the point. The problem with your position is, apart from the fact it makes life more difficult for the government, and I will actually reduce the number of these motions, so the defendants as a group will actually be disserved. But the problem is, it's just so arbitrary. If the government happens to make one of these motions, then a person can say to the court, in effect, well, you know, 13 years have passed. I'd like to be resentenced, right? And things have happened in that time. And you could imagine a system which you have sort of continuous resentencing, you know, like parole. every year you go back to the judge and say, you know, you sentenced me to 25 years, but I'm such a good boy and this and that. And, you know, those were those nasty guidelines, and you really ought to show lenience. We could have a system like this, but we don't have a system like this. So it's kind of half-baked to say, well, if the government happens to move for this reduction, even though it's just for substantial assistance, that's all, that's Rule 35, that is Rule 35B, belated motions for 35B are about, everything's open, and it's, you know, just as going back to the judge and saying 13 years have passed, I want a lower sentence.
Well, I think it's a bit unfair to talk only in terms of mitigation when you talk about the 3553 effect.
Why?
Because they can also be used in terms of aggravation.
What, you mean you can give him a bigger sentence?
He could be given
You can say, oh, well, I only sentenced you to 25 years, but you're a nasty character, and the government has asked reduce your sentence by 2 years. I'm going to increase it by 5 years.
Well, he couldn't increase it. But,
well,
but
then what do you... Well, right, it only goes in one direction.
Well, but if the government... Say the government recommends 20%, the district court could only give 10% based
on... Sure, but the point is he always gets the lighter sentence. It's a one-way street. And he only gets the lighter sentence because it's fine to go down... It's fine to give him what the government wants or give him less than what the government wants. That's fine. The question is, can you give him... You know, six times what the government wants to give him on the basis of considerations have nothing to do with assistance. And no other criminal defendant who's imprisoned for whom the government does not ask for reduction can get that benefit. And it's totally arbitrary. You could have another criminal, the only defendant, the only... prisoner. The only reason that the government never offered him a reduction for substantial assistance was he simply, it was not the kind of criminal activity where he was in a position to help the government with anything. So from a, you know, standpoint of equity or natural justice or something, he's exactly like the fellow who rendered assistance. But because the fellow rendered assistance, he gets to argue not only that his assistance was valuable, but for totally unrelated reasons, he should be resentenced from scratch and given a lighter sentence. Now, what sense does that make?
Well, in this case, it makes sense when a defendant is sentenced before Booker.
No, it doesn't make sense because I can... No, I'm looking at the comparison. Two defendants... Both sentenced before Booker, both given the identical sentence, both with the same equitable claims for a lighter sentence, but only the one where there's a motion for substantial assistance can argue all these points about Booker, about equities, about he's a good boy, about this and that, right? So that's completely arbitrary.
Well, it's a triggering mechanism.
It's completely arbitrary triggering mechanism because it triggers consideration of factors that have nothing to do with substantial assistance.
Well, that's true.
That's arbitrary.
But there's still factors to consider when imposing a reasonable sentence.
Yes, but those factors are not available after a person's been sentenced and the initial period for a Rule 35B motion is passed. That's why I say you can have identical criminal... identically circumstanced, except for the happenstance that one rendered so substantial assistance. And because he did that, under your view, he gets to argue all these unrelated points.
Right.
I don't see what sense that makes, apart from the fact it's contrary to the language of 35B.
It's contrary to the language?
Yes.
Well, we would disagree with
well,
that.
Well, you've got it says substantial assistance.
Right.
That's the title of the rule.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and we would agree that it's a triggering mechanism, that you don't get into court with.
But it's an arbitrary triggering mechanism under your view, because you have all these people sentenced before Booker, and they all have a gripe. They were sentenced under a regime which extinguished the discretion of the district judge. They would all love to be resentenced now. The only ones who get the crack at being resentenced under new, you know, Booker standards are the people who the government happens to think should get a discount for substantial assistance. That's the arbitrariness of your position.
I think when you say everyone would want to be sentenced, I don't know that that's true, because I think what the Palladino remands taught us was that some defendants didn't do better off with a Booker remand.
Yeah, but it's a one-way street. They can't do worse off.
Well, they could have.
No, they can't do worse off. Rule 35B is about reducing sentences, not about increasing sentences.
Well, that's true. But you can.
So on your view, anybody who is sentenced under Booker, before Booker, has a kind of moral claim to a lighter sentence. So that if there's a substantial assistance motion, the person gets to argue, yeah, I should get half the sentence I got because judges didn't have enough discretion before Booker. Right? That argument has nothing to do with substantial assistance. But on your view, someone who doesn't have a substantial assistance motion can't make those arguments, even though he's in the identical position of your client.
But he didn't cooperate, so he's not identical.
It's not that he wasn't cooperative. In my example, he didn't have any information to provide. That's not his fault. That's not being uncooperative.
I mean, that's true. It's not his fault.
But look, I wouldn't. This is more than just the violation of Rule 35. There's an incentive for people to cooperate. In prison often. They hear things in prison, and they could be a benefit to prosecution, but also, from your office point of view, this could be an opportunity for a reduction. But what's the incentive for the government, then, to allow him to use him for a reduction if it's going to open the door to this? This is where I think the concern, we can call it arbitrary, because you can vary in the reduction. Yes, he can take other things into consideration that maybe this cooperation is worth more than 10% and come down lower than that. I can see that, if he can find it to that. But as Judge Posner said, this is just a matter of opening the door for a resentencing. Everybody, I don't know how many people are pre-Booker that are in prison, but they'd all like to do that. Now, maybe you would say, well, maybe this is going to give everybody an incentive to come forward and snitch on people in prison and come forward so they can cooperate in order to open the door for resentencing. Maybe that's the approach you want to take. Because that's what I look at, what the benefit is for the judicial system and for all of that. And I like the idea that people will help to, will offer cooperation to help get other criminals. But if we invert it and say, hey, here's an opportunity to get resentenced, so let's see if we can find ways to cooperate, maybe you can make that argument. But I don't think that's what we're doing here today. I think we're looking at the law and whether or not it's followed.
I think we're still ignoring the inverse on the resentencing, that if we open the door to 3553A, we open it both ways, the aggravation and the mitigation. I mean, we're going down, or maybe we're not going down.
You can't go up beyond the original sentence.
Exactly.
But not only that, how can the defendant lose? I don't understand.
Well, the district court could say you have done this, this, and this in prison. Even though you cooperated, I'm not giving you a reduction.
But that confines it to the law, which is appropriate.
But then he's focusing
on cooperation or lack thereof.
But then he's taking into account other things besides substantial assistance, doesn't he?
Exactly. So if you can go in mitigation, you can go in aggravation. So it's not that a defendant...
Within the range of the government's motion, that's a lot different from going all the way down to zero.
Well, no, it would be to a mandatory minimum if there is one. I mean, a district court should have discretion on a 35B motion.
It could be zero if there were no minimum. If there were no mandatory minimum, go down to zero.
Exactly.
Just let the guy out.
But getting a GED and having a good relationship with the family, even though he's in prison, has nothing to do with substantial assistance.
Well, that's not the issue here. I mean, this is the government only. This court only has jurisdiction over the legal issue. I mean, the extent of the departure and all that stuff, what he did, I mean, that can't possibly be.
But isn't that what happens if you incorporate all of 3553? Doesn't that give that judge an opportunity to take all that in consideration, which I thought this judge did?
Yeah, that's what the district court did in this case.
And that's what we're saying, can you do that or not?
Right, yeah, the legal question, right. But as far as the extent of the departure.
No, it's the legal question.
Right. But again, I think this court wants to make this comparison, the government's symmetry argument, 3553E, but that's a mandatory minimum. I mean, that's when we talk about.
So what? I don't understand.
Well, 18 U.S.C. 3742A gives us jurisdiction to review violations of law. So we have jurisdiction to review. I mean, so how do we get here? What's the violation of law? In a 3553E context, if you go below the mandatory minimum, that's a problem because Congress has said you get 10
years. Well, it's not a problem because you have 3553E. So what are you talking about?
Well, but say in the Johnson case, it's a problem to consider the 3553A factors because there's a mandatory minimum. And Congress says you only go below that based on substantial assistance. In this case, the court didn't go below the mandatory minimum. So what's the violation of law? I mean, it's not 3553.
The violation of law is that 35B is about substantial assistance.
But there's no 35B doesn't say anything about consider other factors.
Well, why does it have to? I mean, why would anyone think you'd be considering other factors?
Well,
it's not a general rule for reexamining sentences many years later. It's to deal with substantial assistance. Pretty odd to say that because you've got a rule about substantial assistance, it allows reopening. I mean, it's ridiculous because parole has been abolished, but you're arguing for a position which is like parole. That is, you get to argue that, you know, you treat this for these people. They have an indefinite sentence, right? They were initially sentenced to 20 years in jail, but as soon as the government files a motion for substantial assistance reduction, that they go to the judge and say, well, you know, as if he were a parole board. You go and say, yeah, you sentenced me to 20 years, but really, as long as I could file a Rule 35B motion, I could always ask, I could turn it into indefinite detention because every time I render additional assistance to government, they file this motion, I go back and I ask and I say, I've served long enough. You should let me out.
Well, again, the facts of this case, Mr. Shelby was sentenced pre-Booker.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Irrelevant to substantial assistance.
But at the end of the day, the court never considered the 3553A factors in the first place. So if there's a mechanism to get Mr. Shelby back in court, then why not?
That makes clear what you're trying to do. Okay, so thank you very much, Mr. Cook. Mr. Chang, you have anything further?
I want you to put this in perspective. Out of 1,000 defendants sentenced in federal district courts, very, very small percentage are ever considered for substantial assistance reduction. Am I correct on that? Only in pretty much in drug cases.
Well, no, I don't think it's just in drug cases.
But it says pretty much only in drug cases.
I think the statistics show about 20% or so of the defendants in our district receive substantial assistance reductions. Not Rule 35, but I mean at the initial sentencing.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about the initial sentencing. I'm talking about after somebody's been sentenced, what is the percentage, if you can tell me, of people who get an opportunity to come back into court on a substantial assistance? I think it's very, very small.
That I don't know. I do not know what the statistics are on that.
And we're talking about arbitrary. It's arbitrary if you have the kind of information you can sell and get a reduction in sentence. Most people don't have anything that they can sell.
Well, I think the arbitrariness that gets injected with a full-blown resentencing, or at least the potential arbitrariness, is displayed by what happened in this case, where a related co-defendant, well, he's a related defendant, another person with whom Mr. Shelby sold drugs with, Tyrone Powell. Mm-hmm. He also provided substantial assistance after he was.
Yeah, but they had very different records.
Well, and in fact, Mr. Powell's record was much better than Mr. Shelby's. Mr. Powell not only provided historical information on the gang in which he was a member, but then he actually arranged for two controlled deliveries of drugs, and he got an 18% reduction in line with our recommendation before another district judge. And whereas Mr. Shelby, who had seven disciplinary infractions in the Bureau of Prisons while he was incarcerated, including using drugs and possessing drug paraphernalia while he was talking to us, while he was purportedly giving all this substantial assistance, he had a much worse record than Mr. Powell did when it comes to his credibility or his potential credibility as a witness and of help to the government. So that's what happens. Mr. Powell gets an 18% reduction. Mr. Shelby gets close to a 50% reduction. So I think that's the potential that's injected. But I see my time is up. If I could just make one last point.
I have one more question, though.
Yes.
If the judge gave, in this case, a two-day reduction in his sentence instead of the 2 years that you were offering him, is that an appealable order by the defendant? I don't think so.
I don't think so, because if the judge assessed the value of the cooperation and thought it was only two days worth, I don't think he, just as...
Well, it's certainly an appealable order, right? What if the judge said, I'm just giving you 2 days because you're black? Right? It's an appealable order. It's a question of whether it's a proper exercise of discretion.
Well, I guess that is a better way to phrase it.
Right, that is correct. If the judge considered something other than substantial assistance, then the defendant could appeal that. But if the judge considered only substantial assistance, for example, if the judge here had said, "I think it's worth a particular amount off because of the substantial assistance," then that would not be appealable by either side.
Can the judge say? You rendered substantial assistance, was very valuable to the government, but you're a really evil person based on the facts of your original. And I don't want to reduce your sentence. Is that permissible?
It actually is, Your Honor, under the Johnson case that this court just decided.
That cuts
against your position.
It does cut against your position.
But that principle has been established for a long time, because that's what happens under 3553E. And what the courts are doing in that situation is relying on the fact that a reduction under 3553E, just as it is under Rule 35B, is discretionary. There is the word may. Okay? The district court may reduce a sentence based on the defendant's substantial assistance. But it is discretionary. So that is why I believe it's the 8th and 11th circuits in Doe and Manila, or actually I think it's the 9th circuit. And these are all cases cited by the Johnson case. That's why courts are permitted to say, look, you are a very evil person. And so your substantial assistance is worth a certain amount off. But because I do have the discretion under the statute, it's may. It is not shall. The judge can consider those factors in denying or reducing the extent of the reduction.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.